1960 last year at the University of Waterloo and received her doctorate in the fall. It's an account of Canada's early history as an aid donor and specifically examined Canada's aid relationship with the largest recipient of that period, India. She's currently teaching part-time at St. Mary's University and conducting research for the Canadian Immunization Research Network examining the history of immunization policy and vaccine hesitancy in Nova Scotia. Certainly need some work on that. John Devlin is a graduate coordinator for the Rural Planning and Development Program in the School of Environmental Design and Rural Development at the University of Guelph. His primary areas of academic interest include the role of the state in development, environmental assessment and public participation, good governance, and agriculture and environmental policy. He's conducted research, provided consulting services in Honduras, Bolivia, Philippines, Vietnam, Egypt, Mozambique, South Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Ukraine. He's a member of the Board of Directors of the Organic Council of Ontario and a regular teaching faculty for the International Comparative Rural Policy Studies Summer Institute. And our third presenter is Stephanie Landgarth. She's an associate professor of history at King's University College of Western. Her research and teaching interests include human rights, advocacy of the history of Canada and the United States, the immigrant experience in North America, and Canadian immigration policy. She's the author of Voices Raised in Protest, Defending North American Citizens of Japanese Ancestry, 1942-49. She's currently working on a political biography of Andrew Bruin, somebody that I once knew. So everybody will have 20 minutes. We'll save all the comments and questions for the end. So we'll do the previous presentations and then we'll open it up for discussion and questions. Jill.
Billions of individuals have been involved, either as participants, sessions, or as donor missionaries, as many of us are. In its short history, aid and other development-oriented practices have been an influential part of foreign and domestic policies in just about every country in the world. So it's a massive subject of study, and it's also very much alive today. So the question O'Sullivan poses is a meaningful one for historians of development and humanitarianism, because the audience of practitioners and scholars that may be interested in their research are indeed people that could impact policy change. O'Sullivan writes that historical research in writing about aid can at the very least, quote, contribute to the development of institutional memory with a positive knock-on effect for contemporary decision-making. For researchers and writers involved in the field of international development studies, primarily grouped within the social sciences, this is pro forma, right? The very origins of the field are rooted in the works of modernization theorists who hope to find the key to economic development within economic or sociological theories. And during the first development decade, the writings were eagerly read by policymakers in Washington. Whether written by academics or practitioners, whether consciously political or so-called bureaucratically neutral, whether theoretical or focused on experience, the field is united in its desire to create change, sometimes revolutionary, sometimes incremental. So in contrast, historians, of course, do make consciously political choices, probably most notably in the turn to social history in the late 20th century. The mechanism of change was the product itself, the decision to research and write histories that had been previously neglected or ignored, or to challenge a long-held conviction of a provocative revision. In general, modern professional historians do not conclude their writing with point form policy recommendations or render morality tales, at least not explicitly. Contrary to popular opinion, historians are the last people to advise that those who do not learn the mistakes of the past are doomed to repeat them. However, it's also safe to say that no historian would consider their research and writing unimportant to modern political and social concerns, and certainly would desire policymakers to be intimately familiar with the history of their field. So this paper will explore two related questions. Why is the history of modern development practice important and useful for scholars and practitioners of international development? Is it? And what challenges and opportunities are presented to historians trying to write history that is also of interest to those engaged in international development studies? And I'm going to use my own dissertation work on history of Canadian aid in the 1950s as kind of a case study. I'm not going to get into each one of these because that would take too long. But obviously, I'm not the first to ask this question. There have been others. In 2000, Nick Culliford, who some of you may be familiar with his book, The Hungry World, which is on the Green Revolution and food aid, American food aid. He argues that history can provide an epistemological context and a long trajectory. There are other who I'm not going to get into each one of them. But what they're sort of united on in their ideas about the value of history in aid is they say it cannot provide. And Jarl Simonsen says this, and he's a Norwegian historian, history is not macro-evaluation. It's not part of the project cycle in that kind of a way. It can't sort of have that specific role. But what he and all of them say is what it can do is provide this context. And so he says history cannot provide a recipe for improvement, but by looking at aid in the wider national and international context, looking for wider functional relations and for dynamics of change, it can provide a basis for reflection. So what all these authors have in common is their belief that historical context can benefit scholars and practitioners of international development. Historical methodology has a high standard of evidence, an ability to draw larger themes from seemingly disparate events, and and a focus on how and why change happens. And so perhaps this can help specialists see their own work as fitting into, or perhaps breaking from, familiar patterns that have developed in the past 60 years of development practice. So seeing their work as part of a broader context may indeed change their perspective and challenge their assumptions about development itself, or about practices, aid practices, and therefore change their future decisions. But it's only by having well-written, accessible, and meticulously researched histories of their respective fields that this can be accomplished. And so that's kind of my first argument, the case that I'm making for history. So in setting out to write my dissertation on the history of Canadian aid in the 1950s, I consciously saw my project as an attempt to create a work of history that would be of interest to scholars in other disciplines, primarily to those within the interdisciplinary field of international development. And I was conscious of this field because of my own background. I did an undergraduate degree in international development studies and kind of maintained an interest in that. So I chose a dissertation project for my doctoral degree. I searched for a topic that would allow me to explore a terrain that kind of fit between these fields. Since the early days of Canadian aid program focused heavily on India, a country with a long and complicated relationship with development and aid, examining the aid relationship between Canada and India was one avenue through which I could fill a gap in the literature and learn more about how to accomplish this disciplinary experiment. How was my work interdisciplinary? Well, according to one definition, interdisciplinary history means historical scholarship which makes use of the methods or concepts of one or more disciplines other than history. Methodologically speaking, my project was not interdisciplinary. And often this is how historians think of interdisciplinarity. They think of using quantitative research, for example, or GIS. There's some fascinating geographical historical research done. My research was the type of standard, detailed archival research favored by historians, and it best suited the project because it served to answer the questions that I was asking. Namely, what factors led the Canadian government to begin giving aid? What role did Canada's relationship to the Commonwealth and the UK play in bringing Canada to the Colombo Plan? How and why, and I should say the Colombo Plan was the first iteration of Canadian aid. It was a Commonwealth organization that gave a supposedly multilateral, but really is bilaterally, between Commonwealth countries and then expanded very quickly. How and why did India play such a major role as a dominant recipient of aid? What factors affected decisions regarding aid? What was the nature of the donor-recipient relationship? And how did the program function on a day-to-day level? So in this way, my methodology did not depart significantly from other Canadian foreign policy histories that look at the Cold War era. Where the project did depart from other Canadian foreign policy histories was in my attempt to situate the historical work within the concepts and theories dominant in international development studies. I'm not the only one doing this, I should say. And to some extent, test my findings against the predictions of those theories. Following the above definition, then, my dissertation could be considered a work of interdisciplinary history. Following other historicists, which is the term Nick Culliford uses to describe work done not necessarily by professional historians, but in a kind of historical vein, and historical literature on development by authors such as James C. Scott, Nick Culliford, and David Ekblad, I use the concept of modernity as a theoretical linchpin of my study. I argue that the ideology of high modernism convinced both Canadian and Indian officials of the rightness of modernization and industrialization for economic development. Understanding this basic premise is fundamental to understanding the outcomes of the aid program, since it determined what type of projects they chose and their shared assumptions about the goals of Canadian aid in India. And using this framework allows for the contemporary observer to read between the lines of seemingly banal discussions of locomotives or wheat or whatever it might be, and find the meaning of development among the bureaucratic discourse. The work of recent theorists of development have done on the inherently patriarchal and hegemonic nature of modernism helps put this bilateral history in a global historical context in a way that otherwise may have been difficult to achieve. And it also made me pay more careful attention to issues that otherwise might have been ignored because of the kind of inherently patriarchal nature and hegemonic nature of the documents themselves, such as the program's gendered nature or its consequences for indigenous rights and peoples. Of course, there are some challenges that accompany this research, and one would be familiar to anyone working within the interdisciplinarity is finding your canon of literature, and then of course it ends up you have about six canons of literature or more, and it, I mean it's something I say it's not unique, it faces many scholars, but it is a challenge worth noting. Another difficulty which manifested in a very particular way in my study was the assumptions that I carried with me into the project. And so I had been armed with a general knowledge of Canadian foreign policy, some familiarity with studies on Canadian aid, but I believe myself to be fairly unknowledgeable about this particular topic and therefore believe that I didn't really have many assumptions going into the project. And I would let the research guide me, and you know, when someone asks me, well, what's your thesis, I'll let the documents tell me. But continually, as I read the documents, I kept being surprised, and of course you can only be surprised if you have assumptions in the first place to challenge, right? So these assumptions I had for many years, through inadvertently, I think, applying theories of development and the aid experience of other donor and recipient countries, like American or European experiences, to Canada and to this era. And so I was not, I would say, surprised to find that Canadian and Indian officials were enveloped in an ideology of modernism, which to some extent dictated their actions, since this theory has been fairly well articulated by many other scholars. But one thing assumption I did have was that the Canadian aid program would be modeled on American programs. I knew Canada had virtually no experience with international aid to the global south, or what was called the third world at that point. And there were some indigenous or economic development programs for indigenous peoples, but I didn't really expect to find too much overt cross-pollination between those programs. But America, of course, in addition to being the dominant world power at the time, does, as David Ekwa has really shown, have this long lineage going back to the 19th century of connections from its imperial development policies, we might say, into the post-war period. And other reading on Canadian foreign aid seemed to suggest that Canadian aid in this period would simply be the earliest iteration of a long history of a program that merely followed international trends over time. And David Morrison, who of course has written the history of CETA, writes that public policy domains exhibit fads, fashions, and pendulum swings. Foreign aid in Canada has been especially prone to frequent twists and turns, and that's been often a critique of the aid program that it merely follows and doesn't lead. I think this is one area in which history itself ended up being quite useful, and that it's obsessed with periodization and proper periodization. And what I found by looking at this period, I found it was itself a distinct era. The 1950 to 1960 time, occurring after the beginning of the founding of the aid program, but prior to the first development decade and founding of major multilateral agencies such as the Development Assistance Committee. And the phrase distinctively Canadian really work to achieve a distinctively American Canadian program founded on very often commercial concerns. So another yes, another point about this, which was interesting, was that calling it a Canadian program was somewhat of a misnomer, since many of the programs were actually Indian programs. They were founded and managed by the government of India and were funded using Canadian aid money, often very much by selling commodities, which generated rupees, which then funded the programs. So the calling it a Canadian program for much of the 1950s, it doesn't quite describe it. So while postmodern theory told me that since the aid relationship was rooted in modernism, high modernism, which is James C. Scott's term, based on a Western epistemological system rooted in dominance, patriarchy, and subjugation, this would predict a donor-recipient relationship also characterized by the supremacy of one knowledge system over another. So this was another assumption I had going into this project. But what I found was that the Canada-India relationship tells a more complicated story. So clearly, the types of projects that India embraced and Canada supported, large dam projects that displaced indigenous peoples, agricultural programs aimed at transforming peasant agriculture, support for industrial transportation system, followed a kind of typical modernization program with all the social, cultural, and economic displacement that accompanies this. However, the archival documentation made it quite clear that Canadian officials, while secure in their belief that Canada's own economic prosperity was a solid model for any developing country, really had little to offer India in terms of a conceptual framework for development in the global south. And what I found was that work really had been done in India prior to independence. Indian officials, with its long colonial history and activist history in Congress and Islamic history there, Indian officials came to the aid relationship with fully formed ideas about what development meant and how it could be achieved based on their own history of colonization and resistance. An idea of development had already been cultivated within India among a Western educated male elite. But the messy pre-independence history of India makes the identification of clear lines between the colonial and the authentically Indian very difficult and pretty much pointless exercise. Following the logic of postmodern thinking may lead one to the conclusion that neither the achievements nor the failures of post-independence government's quest for economic development can really be owned by that country, since they are then merely viewed as expressions of a Western epistemological system that elite officials could not help but act out. However, India's aid relationship with Canada complicates this conclusion. And what I found in the documents was that Indian officials were constantly in a quest for autonomy within that relationship, the donor-recipient relationship, and had, in, for example, active resistance to programs that favored the donor at a cost of recipient, in a total control over the definition and tools of economic development, Indian officials certainly showed no tendency towards subservience. And while I argued that both countries' officials were in the grip of this modernist ideology that to some extent controlled their behavior and decision making, I also argued that Indian officials were active, if not at some points, the dominant partners in perpetuating that belief system, that modernist belief system, and how it then related to aid. So this is not to say that post-development scholars are wrong in their characterizations of modernism, that there's a lot of value there, but just that how it was expressed in specific times at specific places is a very complicated and messy process. So in conclusion, as my experience demonstrates, taking a close look at the archival supposed conventional wisdoms. It can replace supposition with evidence, generalizations with specifics, and fill gaps in the record of both the history of international development as a global practice and the history of individual states. I will say my project had serious limitations, especially given that it was a work of Canadian history, and therefore I could be fairly critiqued for saying that it continues to the long-standing practice of placing the needs of the West before the rest. On the other hand, introducing the voices of Southern government officials into Canadian history is, I believe, an important aspect of my project, even if it is of this certain elite. So one final point I'll just say is that I think possibly looking at the history of Canadian aid, looking that Canada transitioned away from a distinctively Canadian program to one that increasingly one that was increasingly informed by multilateral objectives, and this may offer some explanation to the question of why successive Canadian governments have failed to find a consistent and durable message about and a commitment to global aid programs. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Jill for organizing this panel when she emailed me back in September, maybe October. I recognize this is an opportunity to dust off some work that I had done for my own dissertation about a decade ago and try to fit it together with questions about the role of history in development. My work I would call work in historical sociology, but it's kind of been jumbled historical sociology. So what I resolved to do in this presentation was talk a little bit about my understanding of history and social science, talk a little bit about what I did for my dissertation work, which had to do with agriculture and state formation and the role of the development of the state, and then end with a little bit of a reflection of where historical sociology is at today. So I hope it coheres. I don't think it's terribly long, but Ian might still have to cut me off. Who knows? So the first thing I'd like to do is kind of contrast what in my own mind is a distinction between a historical understanding of research and a social scientific understanding of research. I'm not a historian, so the historians will be unhappy with me, I'm sure. So you can pick on me later, that's fine. I have no trouble with that. But I just wanted to get this contrast up first because I think it's important to bear in mind. So I think that history involves itself with detailed, unique, and very specific studies which try to understand usually a single case. So they're going after great detail and specificity. In doing that, historians recognize multiple causal factors. We call them variables because we're not thinking as social scientists, but factors that explain and describe historical processes. There are many of them, and historians generally embrace that complexity, even though they still do limit their research in various ways, but it tends to be more complex than described for social science. And perhaps most importantly for historians, the truth is in the detail. It's getting as deep and as close to the mechanisms that explain what has occurred as you possibly can. And that's a lot of deep archival work with a lot of dust and all that kind of thing. So that's the forte of the historian. But historians do use social theory. As an historian is trying to understand how a particular event occurred, they will reach out to other types of theory in order to explain whether it's human motivations, economic relationships, social relationships. So historians do use social theory, and they use that theory to explain the specific event or the specific trajectory that they're trying to understand. So that's my quick and dirty take on history. social science, in contrast, tends to focus on general relationships. So it's not the specifics and the details, it's the general. So usually social science will be interested in multiple cases, often many, many, many cases if you're doing quantitative work. But even if you're doing qualitative work, you would probably want more than one case. You would do some kind of comparative study. The number of variables that the social scientist focuses on will tend to be few, and they will be worried about the relationship between those variables in order to explain a general outcome across multiple cases. So for the social scientist, the truth is in the pattern that's found across the cases, the regularity, the associations, the generalizations, or perhaps even the laws that can be discovered in those relationships across multiple cases. So social scientists use historical data in their search for patterns and for relationships. And so that's where we get the subfields of historical social science. Historical sociology, historical economics, historical political science are all drawing upon history to understand and even test theory in social science. So the history is applied to multiple cases in order to draw out those specific relationships. So these are two kind of ideal types, right? Very specific, detailed approach and a very generalized approach. But I think there is a marriage between them, which is actually extremely rich and covers a lot of what we understand as social science in development. In historical sociology, the focus, the look for patterns or generalizations, begins, as Jill pointed out, with the concept of development. That's certainly a foundational concept. Trying to understand what mechanisms drive that process across multiple cases. But once you open up to the notion of looking for historical processes, these processes multiply very, very quickly. So development is modernization, industrialization, or urbanization. There is a cluster there of ideas that come together. They seem to be associated. But that's really just the beginning of the story. Shifting modes of production. Think about a Marxist approach, the historical models of change under Marxism. Capitalist expansion, colonization, commodification, or other series and families of macro social processes that we need to understand historically because these are historical processes. So even as a social scientist, we're driven towards history to unpack these things because they're historical objects that we're trying to understand. But it's much richer than that. Weber on rationalization and bureaucratization, class formation of various sorts, not just Marxist, but American class formation. Corporatization, which is a more contemporary notion about the emergence of these large organizations, multinationals, and so on. Globalization, a very trendy. Secularization, religious decline, as another macro-social process. Nation building, the expansion of civil society, democratization, on and on and on. There's all kinds of social processes that we want to understand, we try to understand as social scientists, but they're historical processes. So we're driven to this middle terrain, I think. Now the two that kind of were my focus, what I got oriented towards, I would call de-peasantization, which is kind of rural decline and the movement of people out of agriculture, and state formation, and most importantly, the notion of the developmental state. So how did I get interested in that? Well, first of all, it was an interest in agricultural transformation. I spent a couple of years in Mozambique in the early 1980s, and one of the things that had happened in Mozambique was almost a complete breakdown between agricultural areas, rural areas, and the city. There was no food in the cities. Huge rationing programs, and this went on for several years. While if you got into the countryside, there was not abundance, but there was food. You could get out, you could find food. So there was a problem here, something in the relationship between the rural and the urban, and that's what I got interested in when I started to think about dissertation. So when I was back in Canada, I started to ask, well, are there historical examples of success? Well, we have the developed countries, and we tend to think of them as successes, all right? But they kind of get eliminated because they're in that other category. They're the developed countries. We want to understand development, which is happening in the global south, or perhaps not. happening in the Global South. Are there examples? And at Carleton, I was very quickly introduced by Fred Bienfeld to the East Asian Tigers, who were a group of countries, most importantly Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan, but also Hong Kong and Singapore. The East Asian Tigers seem to have done something quite remarkable. And I'll focus for the moment just on South Korea, which is this line here. South Korea, in 1950, just before this temporal sequence begins, South Korea had a lower GDP per capita than the Philippines. Today, 2010, here's the Philippines. Sorry, here's the Philippines. And here's South Korea. When I grabbed this data, I wasn't able to get Taiwan. Most of the sort of standard data sets don't include Taiwan because it's a province of China, so it's missing. But if we had Taiwan in here, it would be running between South Korea and Japan. And what was of interest to me was that Taiwan and South Korea had large agricultural populations. So they were like Mozambique and many other developing countries, major populations in agriculture, but they had done something different. They had done something like Japan seems to have done. They had taken basically an underdeveloped agricultural economy and they had industrialized it and increased its per capita income significantly. I was shocked to see in a very recent report on Human Development Report, Human Development Index, that South Korea was only one below Canada, I think in 2010. So it had moved from being a seriously underdeveloped country being pretty close to Canadian standards. That's a pretty amazing transition. So those cases of success, and most importantly, South Korea and Taiwan, really drew my attention. So, well, what's going on there? That's what I need to understand. And the two things that I think were going on there, at least that I focused on, were the issues of their state structure, the capacity of that state to drive the development process, and their programs of land reform and rural development, which were very self-conscious and pursued over at least two decades. And this model in Taiwan and South Korea actually comes from Japan, because it was the Japanese colonial program before the Second World War, and it aped the Japanese own development program, which had come before the Second World War. So there was something going on here that was interesting and important, so that's what I spent a lot of time trying to understand. And in trying to understand it, I went to some theory from social science about what would be the role of agriculture, why would agriculture help to explain the foundations of this developmental success. And in the literature on agricultural transformation, we find that there are a number of things that expanding agricultural output can achieve. So as we raise agricultural productivity over time, we provide inputs to the industrial sector. We provide food to the industrial working class, often in a way that's sort of under the control of the national economy. We provide labor to transfer into those services. We create markets and goods for the industrial products of the emergent industrial sector in those countries. And we can earn foreign exchange. So those contributions that agriculture can make were actually made in South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan, but are largely, I would say, not being made in other developing countries. So one of the questions then is, why? Why isn't this happening in other places? And a big part, I think, of the explanation for why this is not happening in other places is we have to look to the state. It is the role of the state and the activities of the state in the East Asian countries, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, that explains this outcome. So what was going on in the state? Well, the state in those countries had a development project. It wanted development. And it wanted development at almost any cost. Now, there are particularities of that and sort of historically specific, but I do think this is a shared characteristic across these cases. It had a capacity to induce the private sector to undertake activities that were supportive of the development project. And most importantly, it was capable of moving the landlord class, out of possession of agriculture and shifting control over agricultural production to small farmers and to not agriculture cooperatives so much, but farmers associations. Extremely important. In Taiwan, the farmers associations were most important. In South Korea, it was actually government programs of rural development, Saimal Undong, which put a lot of investment into the rural sector, but that was under the control of small communities. And the state had the capacity to manage the social disruption that the development project creates. When you try to induce change, you get resistance. Some of that resistance comes from elites. Some of that resistance comes from masses, comes from both sides. If the state is unable to manage those two forms of resistance to get an outcome that is consistent with the development project, it will get into trouble. And I think this is one of the unique features of these particular states. They were able to manage those relationships. So the hypothesis that emerged from the analysis of that literature, essentially going through and trying to understand what was going on there by reading the literature, was that those countries with large agricultural populations, in those countries, developmental success will require states that pursue a successful project of agricultural transformation. A project of agricultural transformation. Okay, from the literature, I kind of knew that this had already occurred in these countries. My first but unsuccessful effort was to go to the Philippines and try to test out some of these things in the Philippines, but for a variety of complicated reasons, that didn't happen in the end. So what I turned to was actually looking at the experience of the developed countries. I asked the question, well, is this true of Canada? If in fact developmental success is tied in with agricultural transformation, do we find in developed countries, and in my case study Canada, do we find a state which drove an agricultural transformation process through time? So my dissertation work looked from 1780 to 2000 at the role of the Ontario state, so I was looking only at the province of Ontario, looking for the engagement of the state in driving agricultural transformation. I didn't call it the developmental state. I called it the catalytic state. I was trying to sort of distance myself slightly from the development state theory, but the concept was the same. And what I found in general was that, yes, into the 1960s, early 1970s, we could arguably see the Canadian state as a catalytic state, driving agricultural transformation in a whole variety of ways. With neoliberalization in the 1970s, the role of the state begins to change, and in fact, it begins to back off from its transformation project. So that was kind of where my dissertation ended up. So that was the trajectory. So I was looking at historical processes. I was trying to draw knowledge from cases that had been well worked out and then apply them to cases where those ideas had not yet been tried out, but doing that in an historical way. The model that I used essentially looked like this. So this is my dissertation work. A state has a policy agenda which changes economic relationships in some way or other, which drives a set of economic outcomes. And if we elaborate that set of relationships for the agricultural sector in particular, we have a developmental or a catalytic state that has a productivist state agenda, and it pursues a variety of policy areas: settlement, infrastructure development, education, research, extension, market structure management, credit supply, financial incentives and trade management, all these policy sub areas to influence the standard economic variables that drive productivity and yield, which gives us some form of agricultural transformation. So that was essentially the model that I was playing with and went through chapters on all of these different kind of policy drivers. The question that remains and unanswered, because to a large extent the work I do now has not been conducive to doing this kind of historical sociological work, but we need to go back and look at a lot more developed countries and try and understand the role of the state in driving their transformation processes, particularly their agricultural transformation process. So this is work that remains to be undone. Okay, so moving now towards the conclusion and sort of zooming back to the ideas of historical sociology. adapted the literature briefly in preparation for today. I was reinforced in my general sense that the kind of work that I was doing that I just described to you was consistent with mainstream historical sociology as it has been done up through the 1990s. And that version of historical sociology tends to focus on some form of political economy where economic interests are important drivers. Structural analysis is extremely important, abiding features of a system, legal systems, and so on. Institutions, conflict is a focus, power is a focus of interest in understanding large processes of transformation. And lots and lots and lots and lots of researchers have worked in this tradition, including Harry, your dad, looking at historical transformations, but looking for patterns, cross-case capacity. Now, some of these names you might recognize, others you won't recognize. All of these I would consider historical sociologists, but they do not agree with each other. There are huge debates embedded within these boxes, huge fundamental debates about theory. But they do share, I think, this general approach. The second approach to historical sociology, which is more emergent, is really focusing much more on ideas, values, voluntarism, social construction, and culture. It's not nearly so structural and systematic. It is a different way of thinking. And I will be a bit provocative and suggest that I think this is much closer to history than this. I think this writing tends to be closer to history, although from what I've read, historians do not embrace it. It's still sociologists and social scientists who are using these ideas rather than historians. But I do think it is much more specific in detail and not looking so much for generalizations and structures. So this is, I would say, an orientation which is postmodern. Post-development theories, I think, are consistent with this kind of working, and ideas about post-colonialism, I think, are consistent with these ideas. So I think any students coming to historical sociology now would be confronted with this choice and may very well be attracted towards this choice. And I don't want to say don't go there, but there's still a lot up here that's going to be helpful and useful. So let's keep our structural, political, economic hats on and not go completely over to social construction. Although I want to suggest that there is room for a compromise. I did find one very provocative person who took on this notion of ideas, social constructionism, culture, and so on, and expressed his dissatisfaction with it from the perspective of the first tradition of historical sociology. Since the late 1980s, the intellectual scene in the social sciences has been awash with talk of individualism, identity, the self, and social fluidity, all attributed to the pushback of market forces against the state. It is almost as if the collapse of the Soviet Union removed big structures, large processes, and huge comparisons from our shared consciousness and turned our world into one big virtual swimming pool. The macro historical sociologist who wields his or her sword against the half-truths of this conventional wisdom may sometimes feel they are slicing air. It's just not clear what the grounds of the debate is. There's obviously an expression of frustration there. But in fact, I think we can find a compromise between these approaches. And it's partly asking this group of social constructionists to realize that they are reaching for more theory than they tend to think they're reaching for, and getting the more structural first wave historical sociologists to recognize that social construction, voluntarism, ideas are part of those large scale processes that they do want to understand. Ideas are also historical, they're generated in historical processes. So what I would suggest as our kind of compromise position is that we recognize there are no laws of macro historical development. We don't have a law. But we have something. It's more than nothing, because we have processes that have be multiple causal paths to get the same outcome. We can get development in different ways. So there's not one theory, and there's certainly not a law. So there's more than one path, and that's the notion of equifinality, which I think is really important for social scientists to embrace, the concept of equifinality. There are patterns and regularities that invite comparative analysis and explanation. There are unique combinations, yes, in almost every case. We can say that's a unique case in some ways, but there will be some common features, some things that are going on that are shared with other cases, and that is, as a social scientist, what we want to find and understand. So what I want to suggest, and I'm following Charles Tilly in some of his later work in this, is that really what we're looking for are social mechanisms that operate in different historical contexts to give us outcomes that we can understand that cross cases. What is the social mechanism? Well, think of it like a carburetor in a car. The carburetor in the car is not the whole car. The carburetor does not explain the car. The carburetor is one mechanism within the car. And by the same token, an historical process of change does not have one social mechanism. It's going to have dozens, if not hundreds, of social mechanisms. Some of those mechanisms will work the same way in many cases. They will combine together in similar ways. But in other cases, they may combine in different ways. So we need to be able to identify mechanisms, and we need to put them in their context to understand how they contribute to an understanding of trajectories of change. So those social mechanisms are what we should be looking for as social scientists. And most importantly, these mechanisms can be ideational. They don't just have to be structural or institutional. So when we start to think in a new way, when we start to have new goals and perceptions, the social constructivist may see that as being completely unique and something that there's no point in looking at structuralism as a way of understanding it. And I'm going to suggest, no, that's wrong. Ideas take root. They become structures in the very same way that institutions become structures. So if you have cultural structures or ideational structures, you can do histories of those things and how they shape outcomes. So you can understand development in terms of post-colonial relationships or other ideational relationships in terms of the expansion of market society or in many other ways, which are consistent with this kind of second wave of historical sociology, which is more about values and ideas, but which I think essentially is trying to do the same thing with new materials that the first wave historical sociologists. So there's room for both camps to work happily together, but of course, they probably won't. So what's the task for historical development studies, or the lesson for the students, I suppose, here? I would say one thing is to keep the developed countries in the frame. Development is not about the global south. Development is about human societies changing in a direction towards goals or outcomes that they define for themselves or that are imposed upon them. But all human societies are in the frame. Try to identify the social mechanisms that help us understand those transformations, and try to find the social mechanisms that are holding back the transformations, that are inimical to the transformations. And then in terms of our activism, our policy, we want to promote the former and discourage the latter in terms of our teaching and in terms of our policy. Okay, that's it. I gave you some references there. If you chase up the paper, if I can post it somewhere, there's a few references there. Okay.
I'm going to be a little old school here and not have a PowerPoint presentation. I'm just going to tell you a couple of tales here. I'm a historian, I'm a storyteller. I also believe in sort of promoting an activist perspective, both in my teaching and my writing. I guess that's where I've come to in my life at this point now. So I'm hoping that out of these three case studies I'm going to be talking about today and invite you to comment on them later, that perhaps I can bring up some issues, current day issues that, certainly might appeal to those of you in the room who have more present day focus with respect to your studies and also with respect to your own performances in, your own lives and, your own work. Before I go any further, I'd like to thank Jill for organizing this. And I'd also like to thank the Canadian Committee on Migration, Ethnicity, and Transnationalism, which is also a co-sponsor of this panel, along with the Canadian Historical Association and CAFID. Parts of this research today that I'll be talking about is going into the biography on F. Andrew Bruin that Ian Smiley mentioned. And it's also part of a chapter that is forthcoming in an edition or in a collected volume that's edited by Greg Dunahy and Mike Carroll that's titled From Kinshasa to Kandahar. It's on failed states, like I forget the full title, but it'll be coming out with the University of Calgary Press sometime this year, maybe November or something like that. So part of the work on Biafra that I'll be talking about will be featured in that volume. So the title of my paper is Our Assistance Worthwhile? The Role of Tripartisanship in the Canadian Response to Refugee and International Development Crises, 1968 to 1978. When politicians travel to far-flung places, they're often derided, as we know, for going on political junkets. However, in the late 60s and into the 70s, a number of parliamentarians of various political stripes engaged in travels to these far-flung places around the globe to assess international refugee crises and human rights issues in those countries. These individuals, for example, in those days were Andrew Bruin, a member of the Democratic Party, David MacDonald, who was then a member of the Progressive Conservative Party, Keith McCrory, also of the Progressive Conservative Party, Louis Duclos, of the Liberals, Doug Rowland of the NDP, and, others of various political stripes, and also Georges Lachance, the Liberals as well, were active in pushing Canada, this country, to take a larger and more principled and a more prestigious role in world affairs. As political scientists Margaret Keck and Catherine Sicking have noted, contemporary dynamics of social change do occur across international boundaries through transborder alliances forged by individuals and by non-governmental organizations, among others. These parliamentarians that I'm going to be mentioning today, along with others inside and outside government circles and in organizations, believed in the role of international bodies as vehicles of change and observation, and thereby worked to entrench multilateralism as a feature of Canadian foreign relations, development aid, and humanitarian action. That said, these efforts will be weighed against competing voices promoting a more neutral national interest that portended an air of appeasement. So this conference paper is going to explore the role of Canadian bipartisanship, of cooperation, in the articulation of Canada's place in the world. I'll first start off with Biafra. The Nigerian-Biafran conflict that occurred almost 40 years ago marked Canada's first encounter with an African relief effort in a substantial way. While Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau at the time rhetorically replied, "Where's Biafra?" when asked what role Canada would play in humanitarian relief efforts, groups of Canadians from across the country, including those from CETA and in the various Canadian churches, combined their resources to form CanAir Relief, which was an air relief aid organization to supply the breakaway nation with food for a population that was starving. In Parliament, Andrew Bruin kept that issue alive, as the debates in the House of Commons suggest, over the course of 1968 to 1970. But little is known about Canada's role, or actually its inaction, in this conflict for the most part. There's very little historical scholarship on this by historians, although that's going to be corrected soon with my own work, and then, of course, the work Will Tate, among others. As a Christian socialist, Bruin was well aware of the responsibilities that the churches bore in the colonial project in Africa and battled for a more responsible effort towards post-independence Africa from his fellow parliamentarians. And Bruin, along with those both within and outside government circles, believed in the role, as I mentioned, of international bodies. change and observation, and thereby, as I mentioned, work to entrench this feature of multilateralism in Canadian foreign relations. Biafra raised many issues that are still of importance today, including the legitimacy of the so-called war on famine, meaning of genocide, and the limits placed by international law on a nation's sovereignty when it violates basic human rights. At this time, as I mentioned, Canair Relief was something that was organized by a number of Canadians, both outside of government circles, churches, and whatnot. It was created in the late 1960s in 1969. It operated for about a year or so, and in terms of that year-long period of its operation, it undertook 670 covert flights into Biafra and delivered 11,000 tons of desperately needed food and medical supplies to people in Nigeria. All of this was done without official sanction from the Canadian government. Other countries, however, at the time were sending aid directly, such as France, Portugal, and Israel. So activists at the time, such as Ted Johnson of the Presbyterian Church of Canada and his team, decided to go the political route and arrange for MPs from three different political parties to join together and undertake an observation mission into Biafra. Of those three political parties, the following members were chosen or who volunteered: Progressive Conservative MP David MacDonald, who was a United Church minister from the East Coast, and Andrew Bruin, an NDP Anglican layman but high churchman, Bobby was an Anglican bishop, who was from Toronto, and also originally James Walker of the Liberal Party was going to join them. When Trudeau found out that Walker was going to join them, after he promptly appointed Walker as a parliamentary secretary to something, and so Walker was grounded. So MacDonald and Bruin fly into Biafra on a Canair Relief flight to embark on this fact-finding mission. John English notes that this trip infuriated Trudeau, not surprisingly. This was a very risky, in Trudeau's mind, because he was convinced that support for the separatist breakaway state of Biafra was risky, obviously, for the situation of Canada at this time, with respect to Quebec. But Bruin and MacDonald's fact-finding mission did increase a great deal of public interest and considerable activity in the House of Commons. They published a book on their fact-finding mission titled Canada and the Biafran Tragedy, that was published in 1970, that recommended that Canada use its position to prod the UN to negotiate a ceasefire, to have Canada participate in relief operations, to push to have Nigerian civil rights violations under the UN Charter enforced, and to give money for humanitarian relief. One of the main issues addressed in the report as well is the question of federalism and how the federal desire to preserve one Nigeria and the Biafran claim to self-determination effectively shaped Canadian attitudes towards the conflict. Bruin and MacDonald kind of said that was a very specious argument, in fact, that the comparison drawn between the secession of Biafra and the threat of secession in Quebec was really kind of thin at best. And certainly, Bruin and MacDonald noted that on really in all things being considered, raising the whole issue of Quebec separatism was really just a kind of a ghost specter, because it was very clear that the Liberal Party was not going to be supportive of sending aid into Biafra at this time. The Nigerian conflict continued to be present in the House of Commons, due in large part to the efforts of these parliamentarians throughout the 60s and into the 70s, and also due to the fact of the cooperation with non-governmental organizations via Canair Relief. This flight program continued to go on into the 1960s. Finally, a major breakthrough occurred, which in Bruin's own words was described as being directly as a result of successful pressure on the government by interested groups and the public, and that was that on January 9th, 1970, the Trudeau government did decide to allocate funds for relief, including $1 million for Canair Relief for that flight program. However, not 3 days later, on January 12, 1970, the Biafran resistance collapsed, rendering void the monies that the federal government set aside for Canair Relief. Moving on to the refugee crisis in Bangladesh and Pakistan. In July of 1971, Bruin, George Lachance and Keith McQuarrie visited India and East and West Pakistan to see the refugee camps coming out of the conflict there at that time. For this, they also received some criticism from the press, who referred to these trips in somewhat contemptuous terms, I mentioned junkets. Later on, a few years later, in February of 1974, Bruin would also travel once again to Bangladesh at this time, to kind of see what was going on in the aftermath of the conflict and to see what had happened in the meantime with respect to the refugee situation. So he traveled with colleagues from the Progressive Conservative Party, Heath McQuarrie, and Doug Rowland of the NDP to Bangladesh as guests of the Bangladeshi government. All three were actually members of the Canada External Affairs Committee at the time. They had the opportunity to speak with the president, the prime minister as well, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, the foreign minister, the minister of finance, the minister of law and parliamentary affairs, and a number of other government officials at this time. They also made visits into the country by helicopter, inspecting a rehab hospital, an irrigation project, a hardware factory, a newsprint mill, cooperative academy, all of this kind of stuff, and other places to which Canada had provided development aid and technical assistance. An overwhelming impression of their trip was one of friendship and goodwill towards Canada, of course. Bruin noted in his report that he felt as if he was on a mission of goodwill, that they were accomplishing something. He was able to note how in place of his visit in 1971, by 1974, there had been some progress made, I suppose, as he noted. Canada was contributing food grains to Bangladesh at this time, as development aid. And in pondering the question, is our assistance worthwhile, Bruin, McQuarrie, and Lachance answered with an emphatic yes in their report, although privately they kind of questioned that a little bit. They wanted, obviously, to present a very positive report to the Canadian public and to their fellow parliamentarians. As they stated in the report, Canada's greatest external interest is in world stability. Bangladesh occupies a key position in the subcontinent of Asia, is a sister Commonwealth nation fighting for stability and democracy against great odds, and in the difficult task of building a stable world community, Canada's good relations with Bangladesh can play a significant role. A few years later, South America would be in the headlines. So I'm moving on to my third case study here. Bruin would be at the forefront of efforts to remove bureaucratic roadblocks for would-be Chilean refugees. Conversations about a fact-finding mission began almost as soon as concerns about Chile were raised in the House of Commons, especially by the spring of 1976, with increasing reports of imprisonment and exile for political reasons, harassment of refugees, and repression of human rights and exile in Uruguay were heard alongside the continuing news of oppression in Chile in the aftermath of the Pinochet coup in 1973. The Interchurch Committee on Chile agreed to sponsor a fact-finding mission, again by three parliamentarians, to the three countries of the so-called Southern Cone of Latin America. Several other Canadian organizations were also active in Chile and in development issues at this time, including Amnesty International, Office of Canada, and the Canadian Catholic Organization for Development and Peace. So we're all these efforts too. The purpose of the mission of these parliamentarians was twofold: to undertake an observation and evaluation of the situation of refugees and the Canadian response to their needs, and to observe the general situation of human rights in these countries that were visited. During their time in Argentina, so each of the three MPs, I forgot to mention who they were of course my man Andrew Bruin again, David McDonald, his partner in crime, and Louis Duclos of the Liberal Party. During their time in Argentina, they met again with various UN officials and government individuals. They met with the Canadian ambassador to Argentina, human rights organizations, and a number of Chilean refugees themselves. Beyond learning the conditions in Chile, Uruguay, and Argentina were dismal in regards to human rights violations and persecutions at the hands of right-wing death squads, they also learned the plight of refugees from Chile and Uruguay, many of whom were living in terror and were being kidnapped and returned to their homeland, and all of this. As part of their fact-finding mission, they also examined the Canadian program to assist refugees. As there was no refugee policy specifically in place in Canada at this time, these measures were done on a group by group basis, which has been problematic and quite controversial from time to time. As of July of 1976, at that time, the Canadian government pledged to accept 6,000 refugees from Chile, but they were very slow in moving on this. The main concern that Brew and McDonald and Duclos found with the acceptance of the refugees by Canadian officials was that of delay, a deliberate delay. The processing of refugee applications from Chile took on average 4 weeks, during which time applicants would be in danger of seizure by the Chilean police. And I contrast this with the fact that there were no similar delays encountered in bringing Hungarian refugees in 1956, Ugandan Asians in 1972, or Vietnamese in 1975. In fact, the Canadian government was able to grant refugee status to 6,000 Ugandan Asians in the first 2 months of 1972, yet took 18 months to admit the first 1,500 Chileans after the Salvador Allende government fell. The Canadian government also did not do away with prior medical security and immigration procedures to speed up the removal of Latin American refugees, and RCMP officers in Santiago turned down a high proportion of the initial wave of refugee applications on the basis that they comprise security threats for Canada. The government painted the Chilean refugees as subversive and dangerous to Canada, which was certainly out of step with the feeling of the large majority of the Canadian population at the time. And the government was also out of step with efforts of other nations, including Holland and Sweden, who were treating the Chilean refugees outside the normal flow of immigrants. So for their part, the three MPs recommended in their report that standards for the definition and admission of refugees be clearly set out in legislation, or at least placed in explicit regulations. And along with the report's recommendation that separate and suitable application forms for refugees be prepared, Brew and McDonald and Duclos recommended that all UN-accredited refugees be considered as refugees for the purposes of Canadian immigration, which, of course, we were not doing at this time. Ultimately, their report actually contributed to major policy change with respect to refugee policy, which would be enacted in 1978. So, to conclude, so to provide some conclusions here about what's the so what of all this, as we historians are often asked to do, as Jill nicely phrased better than I have. However, I had a wonderful dissertation supervisor who, after I gave him my first draft of my dissertation, wrote on a little post-it note at the top, what's the so what of all this? I keep that post-it note on my computer screen, and I provide it to all of my undergraduate students as well. It's something that we all have to keep in mind, not just what's the so what of all this, but really, what are we hoping to do with this history? So I'm hoping now to kind of give some thoughts here. As Ian Smiley has noted, the major humanitarian challenge for the UN and for donors is to create a strengthened multilateral core which has the capacity, resources, and mandate from its members to meet humanitarian needs in a more impartial and effective manner. A strengthened multilateral system of financing and implementation is an investment in a more proportional and less politicized response to human need. Something which these parliamentarians that I've been describing have asked over the course of their activism. Just the same idea. And indeed, as Karen Kenny has asserted, humanitarian action is part of a system of official development assistance that is increasingly rights-based. Right to life, food, shelter, and basic health and education are core tenets of humanitarian law, the UN Charter, the Declaration of the Rights of the Child, and a dozen other charters, codes, and sets of standards in countries and major bodies around the world. In each of the cases described herein, the discussion of moral issues by the ruling governments of the day remained disturbingly absent, leaving dissenting voices to members of opposition parties and government backbenchers in cooperation with NGOs and other groups in creating public awareness and implementing Canadian government action. These cases do demonstrate the ability of parliamentarians to transcend party boundaries on important issues of the day, to be activists, to harness public opinion, cooperate with aid organizations, and to affect outcomes in government, either as opposition members and or members of the ruling party. These case studies demonstrate these individuals as being partners and not partisans. Was their assistance worthwhile in each case? A qualified yes. As Harold Trumper has noted, by the 1970s, it was widely held that Canada was then and haven for the oppressed. In retrospect, the public imagination turned a select series of economically beneficial refugee resettlement programs into a massive and long-standing Canadian humanitarian resolve on behalf of refugees. So in this case, the idea is actually not really implemented. It's the notional idea that we cling to rather than the practical outcomes. In the case of Chile, after the Allende government in Chile was overthrown, groups in Canada, particularly the churches, urged the government to offer protection to those being persecuted, but the Canadian response was slow and reluctant. 7,000 Chileans finally made their way into Canada, finally. However, it's not to argue that Chilean refugees were any more or less deserving of Canadian asylum than other refugees. On the contrary, the Chilean case clearly indicates that just as Canada's response to humanitarian abuse could be tempered by economic self-interest could also be tempered by political considerations. In the case of Biafra and Pakistan and Bangladesh, large numbers of internally displaced persons, starving and politically persecuted, occupied for a time the conscience of Canadians. Canada, which was facing its own internal separatist threat, was reluctant to extend aid to an area trying to separate from a fellow Commonwealth member, particularly in a region in which it had no prior experience. However, early assistance was provided with food, material, and military transport aircraft for several months, the Can Air Relief Program, and then this airlift was directly influenced by the work of Bruin and McDonald in cooperation with some important non-governmental organizations. The airlift as well, too, is kind of this interesting legacy of the Biafran situation as it affected the civilian population very significantly, and also provided a potent example of the power of public opinion and an inspired civilian populace. Subsequent famine relief efforts in places such as Ethiopia, Somalia, and former Yugoslavia by world governments were not met with the same response as Biafra. As Richard Pilkington has noted, as a provider of substantial amounts of development aid and as a partner in Pakistan's nuclear power program, Ottawa had established an important relationship with Islamabad. Despite knowledges of the atrocities in East Pakistan, the Canadian government chose not to exert hard influence by threatening to withdraw aid or technical assistance, but to adopt a four-strand policy based on neutrality, the private encouragement of a political settlement in South Asia, calls for restraint to both India and Pakistan, and the provision of humanitarian relief. This approach served to protect Canada's relationship with Pakistan, deemed desirable in terms of the national interest narrowly construed, and maintained Canadian neutrality with regard to a foreign secessionist issue that might have stirred up local comparisons with its own separatist debate over Quebec. Nevertheless, there remained in Ottawa's policy and in the government's failure to adjust that policy over time, despite the efforts of parliamentarians, an unfortunate absence of principle and an uncomfortable air of appeasement. Today, in Syria, there's a humanitarian aid and refugee crisis. Today, in government, we have partisans, no partners. It's more challenging than ever before for churches and NGOs to sponsor refugees in this particular case, as I'm finding out in my own efforts to help sponsor Syrian refugees. Those of you who work in international development know the lay of the land regarding the current federal government's approach to that. And today, I wonder, as I ask my students in many of my classes and elsewhere, where's the conscience of Canadians today, and where are the political partners to harness that. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much. We've got three very different presentations, but I think they all underline the importance of history and our approach to international development. I have lots to talk about. I thought I'd make just two or three comments. First of all, I speak as a practitioner, where international development is concerned, memory is a huge problem. And it's hard to know why it is such a big problem. Part of it is that a lot of the people who work in international development are very well intentioned, very highly motivated, but they have tendency to think that the world began the day they arrived. And that goes for the youngest volunteer who goes out to do something in a rural area in Zambia, and it goes for the newest Minister of Development. They all want to put their own stamp on things. They don't much care what went before. And it's very hard to find out what went before because there aren't very many historians actually applying themselves to story. This is a big problem. Another aspect of the problem is the political economy of development assistance. Everybody wants results. Everybody wants success. You know, if we knew how to end poverty, we would have done it a long time ago. The problem is we don't know. We don't know how. A lot of what we're doing is experimental. And we should be treating it as experiments. We should be learning from the failure as well as the success. We should stop punishing people for failing. We punish people for failing over and over and over again by doing the same thing over and over again. But our failure to learn from failure is one of our biggest problems in the development business. And when we have a government that insists that all money has to go into projects that are successful, then we cover up the failures. We fib, we pretend, and we hide the real history. I don't want to take too much time, but I just have to say, Stephanie, that was a trip down memory lane for me.
Yeah.
I spent 2 years in Bangladesh after the liberation. I spent 3 years in Nigeria during the war. I don't know whether you've run across stuff that I've written, but I have a fairly strong opinion about the relief effort in Biafra. I'm totally convinced that the humanitarian agencies extended the war by at least 6 months and contributed to the deaths of a great number of people. And it wasn't because they didn't know what was going on. I think they wanted to believe that there was going to be a genocide if the Nigerian side won. There was plenty of proof by the last 6 months that there was not going to be a genocide. I mean, it could have happened some elements of the army could have gone berserk, but by then the Nigerian army had overrun large parts of Biafra. There were many, many Igbo areas that were living peacefully under Nigerian military control. So I think there was enough evidence to know that there wasn't going to be a genocide. The relief agencies weren't just flying in food; they were buying food locally, and they were buying it with Biafran currency that they exchanged at a ridiculous exchange rate. Biafran currency was worthless, but they exchanged it $5 to the Biafran pound, and those $5 for every Biafran pound used to buy food locally, Biafra was one big yam patch by the end. Every Biafran pound that was exchanged at $5, that money was used to buy weapons. Ojukwu said afterwards, the only thing that kept them going at the end was the money that they were getting from the humanitarian effort. The humanitarians weren't giving them cash to go and buy guns. They were using the money to buy food, and that was the trade-off. Okay, I don't want to say any more. Let's open it up for discussion and questions for all three of our presenters. Why don't you guys sort of turn around so you can see? Could you give your name, please? Yes.
Wadi Robles from Brandon University. I have a question for John and just a brief comment on the last presenter. You didn't mention actually in the presentation, perhaps the time or whatever, it was actually the context of development, particularly the Cold War context in the developing of actually Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. You mentioned actually the so-called success of the agricultural transformation, certainly, but there were conditions for that. In fact, actually, it was very expensive for the U.S. to be providing billions and billions of aid to Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. You know, they wanted to be actually self-reliant. That certainly wasn't the case with Latin America. Latin America, you know, peasants, agriculture, they never had access to the U.S. market, with actually Taiwan, you know, South Korea, and Japan did. I mean, it's, people don't recognize it, how the United States actually facilitated industrialization and in Asia by opening up those. So I think perhaps actually if we take a little bit into consideration that context actually can help us to understand, you know, that all the failures in the South or in the North is actually the interest, the political condition that exists between actually North to South, and the self-interest as well, in this case the United States. So I'm going to stop there. And the last presenter, actually, you talk about Chilean, you know, and the good intention of Canadians. Is that I believe, actually, Canadians have a really good heart and everything, but in most cases, actually, there's a misguided feeling. They don't understand the context as well. When you mention, actually, why the Chilean is starting coming as a refugees, perhaps, actually, you don't recognize there were hundreds of Chileans who have taken off over residence in the Canadian embassy in Chile, and they, you know, making the life of the ambassador in the site miserable. They wanted to, you know, to take all those Chileans back because they were not going to give to Pinochet. So there was a push actually to address the problem, humanitarian disaster in Chile, by literally, you know, opening up, you know, the or bringing all those refugees to Canada. No surprising. As soon as the Chile started coming, more people starting actually occupying the Chilean the Canadian embassy, because that's one only way how to get out of the country. You see. So this is a little bit coincidence in here in terms of actually Canadians. We understand actually sometimes, this is certainly the case, and you mentioned Syria, we are addressing the symptoms of the problem, mm-hmm. not the root cause of the problem. You see, it's highly hypocritical of the government as well, now actually asking for the churches to be sponsoring refugees when they are bombing the hell out of the city. Mm-hmm. You see, creating actually a massive displacement of people, you know, and they are under the slogan of fighting or combating terrorism. So there's a little bit inconsistency there, you see, which actually needs to be recognized.
Let's take a couple and then we can let our presenters respond. Somebody else here?
Just, I guess this is more as much a comment as maybe a question for Gerald. I just wanted to say, thanks very much for such a self-reflexive paper, where, you know, I think it's fair sometimes at Congress anyway to just be saying, here are the limits of my research, here's what it adds, here's where perhaps other things need to be addressed, and just your willingness to kind of set out how you embraced interdisciplinarity and complexity in your work, I thought was really refreshing and a nice way, kind of, for me anyway, to end CHA. I guess maybe I'm going to ask you to push you a bit further in that regard. You know, you were talking at one point about how to call this a Canadian program is a bit of a misnomer because so much of this was Indian driven. And you know, we're also talking about the fact that you have Indian officials who had adopted a certain epistemology, a certain, as you put it, Western-based idea of development. And so I'm wondering if maybe even going beyond, beyond the bilateral, I guess I'm saying beyond the nation here. I think we can be making the argument, especially in this context, that what we're talking about here is a transnational phenomenon of development. And I guess maybe if you could maybe add a couple of insights or comments about how you see interdisciplinarity allowing us to excavate that transnationalism a bit more. Maybe it's a way to link up to the second talk as well. Actually, all three talks, to be honest. So I don't know if you have anything you want to add in terms of transnationalism.
Well, I guess what gave me this kind of nation approach or international foreign policy, you might say, as opposed to transnational, was the fact that I was looking at the bilateral programs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much Canada, India.
Mm-hmm.
And where perhaps the more what you're talking about, this transnational phenomenon of development that's happening worldwide, I tried to access that through the theory,
mm-hmm.
and drawing on other and sort of to Well, actually, there was a lot of literature in Europe that I actually wasn't aware of till after I submitted the thing, and
As is
then
always the case.
went back and revisited.
Yeah.
And to say, okay, this is where there are areas of overlap, and this is where there is something useful about looking at this particular experience. And that's the argument I was trying to make, that the specificity of history can maybe act as a bit of a resistance to a trend to generalize. That if you're trying to look at too many cases, you may put one stamp on all of them and miss things that are happening in the specific experience and at that specific time. However, having said that, I think the transnational studies is extremely useful. And one of the things I would like to pursue more is what I was saying at the end about the way development was framed within India prior to independence, at the time of independence and prior to independence. And that's also very transnational. There's elements from the United Kingdom, obviously, from the Soviet Union, the Indian nationalists themselves, Congress, different viewpoints within Congress. There's Gandhism, and then there's the more Nehru state-led kind of thing. And that is fascinating to me. And if anyone has any suggestions for reading, I'd happily
Can we let John and Stephanie answer the first comments, and then we'll take another round?
Sure. Wilder, you're absolutely right. The sort of aid programming or financial flows from especially the United States to Taiwan and South Korea were really important, especially in the early Reconstruction period, the late 1950s through the 1960s. But I don't think it's explanatory. You have the example of Egypt, very large recipient of U.S. aid, the example of Pakistan. So the aid itself was a conditioning factor, and I absolutely agree that it helped, but it doesn't explain the outcome. I think it was the way in which that aid was used and the agendas which the state pursued, made possible by that aid, that really explains the success of those cases. So yes, we need to find a way to transfer resources to help these processes, but we need a governance that has the capacity to make those resources work developmentally.
Stephanie?
Thanks very much for the point about the large number of refugees that bombarded the Canadian embassy. In a 20-minute conference presentation, it's tough to provide all of the details, but I'm very well aware of that migration factors are both push and pull factors, and that was certainly one of the push factors, I suppose, that pulled Canadian involvement into Chile.
Carrie, did you have a yes, please.
Well, I welcome very much the historical approach to development. And so I enjoyed John Devlin's presentation. But I must say that the story of the success of Korea and Taiwan is perhaps it proves really how important the detail of history actually is to that particular situation. Because the fact is that take Korea alone, was a colony of Japan. And from the time the war finished, first the people considered the United States as liberated of their Japanese occupation. I think quite justifiably. But secondly, the elite, such as they were able to inherit all the whatever the Japanese had owned in Korea was nationalized and became the basis of some of the businesses that later grew to be the big chaebols. And so the other point that did occur to me in that discussion, it was between agriculture and the state, really, I think, one of the very important missing components to look at historically. It's the nature, the nature, if you wish, of the elites of that particular country. And what was unique in many ways about the Korean development, particularly the Korean, was the fact that these big industrial groups, the chaebols, are basically Korean families. They have grown very big. They are in national companies, they have foreign capital who now buy into them. And the difference between the Latin American development, where many of these families, of course, were big landowners benefiting from export agriculture and mineral and so on, without going into details, I don't think. And the other thing is that I think we should face the fact that some of the things we learn from the historical point of view may not be pleasing to our idea of what we like to see. And Korea, again, is really a point in time, because after the revolt of students in the early 60s was a crackdown with a dictatorship by General Park for 2 decades. But this military man and his people were very close with the tribals and very effective in orchestrating a very complex and effective set of incentives that led to the very rapid industrialization of the country and success in exports. Without going into the detail, it's what I used to teach, the detail of this. But it contradicts our general claim that democracy is the most effective form of government for developing countries. And I'm not saying that it isn't, but I'm saying one of the things about history is that we have to respect what we discover, whether we like it or we don't. And just on that note, I would say we have to understand the shifting power relations in this world and the fact that we in the West are not as we were even 30, 40 years ago, the bringers of all truth and of all good things. And we have much to learn from the success, particularly in Latin American countries, of having reduced income inequality, of having seriously reduced poverty also in China. So let me just rest it there.
Okay. John, would you like to comment on
that? No, I just agree with Carrie. Carrie always disagrees with me. We have some agreement. And I would underline the notion of democracy. And we should remember that all of the developed countries developed under non-democratic systems. Long before our democracy was in place, most of our industrial transformation had occurred.
Right.
Kevin Burchett from the Royal Military College. And I just want to sort of pick up on a theme that I think you did, Ian, in the sense that memory is a problem, because I think you're right bringing up this notion here that development is not just about the global south, that you have to include the developed world, or what we know, what we then call sometimes the developed world, and that this was recognized in the late 60s, early 1970s by NGOs and others, that you couldn't just. Development wasn't something that one did to the global south, right? But it had to be understood in a larger way. And the same thing around, in the 70s, you bring up the issue around these arguments around that aid, and we still use these arguments today, that aid will provide global stability. If we have the 99% or 1%, or we have failed states like Afghanistan or South Sudan, it sort of breeds conflict and all kinds of other things. But even in the mid-1960s, we had these notions that aid equaled stability was not true. And that, in fact, when you look at the history of the Pearson Report, Pearson is being told, don't go down the aid equals stability route, because we're not sure that there's any links there. So I think once we kind of, maybe this is where some of this stuff gets into, is that once we get into the details and we unpack some of these kind of generalizations, we realize that some of these generalizations of what we think we know, or what we think we know about the past, aren't there. That there is some of these things that we might think are current today aren't really current, and that they do have roots, they do have past, and sometimes they've been passed over. Right? And maybe they can understand why we keep returning. notion that people very early on understood that development is not something that we understand as one group doing to another.
These are some very basic historical facts. We don't seem to be able to get a grip on them. You may have heard recently, it's being repeated by the World Bank, the economists, the BBC, and everybody else, that we've halved poverty in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You can't, we're down to 1.1 billion. You can't find any contemporaneous figures from 20 years ago that show that we're 2 billion people. There were never 2 billion people. The revisionism is staggering. Other comments or questions?
I'm not a historian, so I came here sort of curious about the approach of history in this context of development. And I have two questions. One has to do with the third speaker. You seem willing to try to answer questions around what history means in terms of context. You seem more willing than most historians, I think, to do that. What accounts, in your opinion, and this is totally asking for your you must have given some thought to this, the discontinuity, perhaps, between Canada's self-perception, right, and the history, a bit what Ian is talking about. Outside, the people outside of the historical context, you look on and you wonder, what accounts for the strong perceptions a population may have of itself? And there are probably some social scientists who have some answers to that, but I'm asking from a historical perspective. And the obvious facts of the issues as you see them.
So what accounts for the disparity between the myth and the reality?
Yeah. We can't turn around the whole thing, but yes. I find it quite curious, for example, Canadians have this, let's think migration, something I know a bit better. The history of Canada's migration. The historical account, as I understand it, is one of quite a bit more racism, in fact, deeply racist attitudes. And yet Canadians remember, for example, blacks either being here or not being here in very interesting ways, right?
You and I would get along very well because I started off by studying race, slavery, and imperialism. I'm not in Canadian context, but in an international history context from the 17th century to the 20th century. And it was through that study, especially of race or the lack thereof in Canadian history, that led me to incorporate that in every single course that I teach on a constant basis. Because every single year, I love getting my course evaluations, not to read what they say about my teaching abilities, but to read in every single comment in my one Canadian history survey class, why do you always tell us the bad stories in Canadian history that make us feel bad? And every time that happens, I feel great. Because I know I have unsettled them. And that's important, and especially when we are talking about race and also about gender issues, income disparity, I want to unsettle them and have them go away, perhaps angry at me for distorting their idealized version of Canadian history, but then down the road remembering what that meant and what that means for them in their daily lives when they eventually do emerge from their privileged pupae into the world where they are confronted with challenges and how perhaps then they might think, oh, Vanguard told me about that story at that time. And maybe it will, I'm also an idealist, I suppose, still, even after being, in the biz for a bit now and beaten down in some ways in various forms and varieties. But that maybe they'll think, oh, that historical lesson, maybe I can do something. It doesn't have to be a big thing, but to do something. And that initial unsettlement may be recalled in some other kind of situation. So that's the whole point, I guess. I don't know. This is I'll be reflective now and gathering inspiration from one of my colleagues.
Well, I'm actually just wondering if maybe Ted, I'm sorry to put you out on this, but could comment a little bit about the ways in which the Canadian government used
well,
in the past
too.
Idealism to perpetuate its own power systems or whatever.
That's what we have today.
Yeah, still. My research focuses on how the Canadian government used sort of Canadian identity to sell aid to the Canadian public and build partnerships with churches and NGOs and entities. And in a nutshell, telling people that you want to, do foreign aid in order to fight communism works okay, but to tell people that you're doing foreign aid because Britain and America expects you to, and if you don't, then that's going to make other things you really want hard to do, is not a great way to sell a political program to the public, especially when you're sending their tax dollars overseas and they're getting no sort of discernible immediate benefit for that. So what they do is through a variety of ways, they sort of try to attach foreign aid to sort of different stereotypical Canadian values. They try to attach it to the generosity that sort of comes out of World War II when we helped Europe and sort of helped rebuild England, and they try to attach foreign aid to these sort of different myths of Canada to try and not so much to sell it as a political program, because you don't win elections saying you have a great foreign aid program, but to prevent political criticism. Because foreign aid can, as you see through the sort of Bevo to orange juice situation, can derail other things that you're trying to do politically. To sort of address your question on why there's this sort of detachment between sort of the ideals of the Canadian identity and what the government's doing or what's happening on the ground, there's a detachment at the government level to what they sort of say in their speeches, what Canadian sort of foreign aid is about, and what their actual motivations are have never really been something.
Other comments? Yes, please.
Perhaps I should close I'm saying actually foreign aid becomes relevant, particularly actually Canadian foreign aid. I mean, it's totally relevant. Peru, for example, where I come from, receives $6 billion a year now out of foreign remittance. The Peruvians living actually in Europe, United States, we are sending 6 million homeless back home. Canadian aid to Peru has 150 million. So when I talk actually to government officials, they laugh and say, they used to give GI in the past, $200 million was really good money. Now, 150, 200 million to give, nothing. I mean, and they come, they impose so many conditions to do this, to do that, accountability, and all the things. For the government, actually, has become relevant. No surprising, actually, they're not really willing to accept the money anymore because actually give the local governments more work. What the Peruvian government is doing, for example, is beefing up service in Peruvian consulates in Toronto, in Vancouver, in the United States, Houston, places where actually it's a large Peruvian community, sending money home. So that has drastically changed the way actually how we used to look at foreign aid. And you see how much money we are giving, $4 billion a year, has been going down. And that doesn't count actually the money spent here. So, I don't see any future for foreign aid in Canada, Now, you ask the Chinese. China's investing heavily, billions and billions of dollars in Latin America and Latin America. They are so happy saving aid from China.
Of course, Peru was only added to the aid list lately because Canada was trying to conclude a free trade agreement with Peru and had a lot of extractive sector companies in Peru. It really had nothing to do with any particular needs in Peru. In fact, most most bilateral aid agencies were pulling out of Latin America because of the reasons you say. Nothing much to contribute.
I was just going to say, when Canada gave to the Colombo Plan in the 50s, there was a lot of fanfare, and the 10th anniversary, there was stamps and all kinds of things. But the first year it gave about $25 million for the entire South and Southeast Asian area. That's quite a number of people. $25 million is spread out among, and then it goes up over time. But if you do the like inflation calculations, it doesn't really do much. And then of course when CETA comes along in 1968, some of those things change. But I think it's what I argued in my dissertation was Canada was fairly irrelevant to India. I mean, it played some role, diplomatic roles, but I think India was quite important to Canada because it sort of India being was considered to be this dominant southern partner, I suppose, a partner because it was influential, and it helped Canadian officials conceptualize what the heck they were doing in giving aid overseas. So in terms of Canadian foreign policy and Canadian foreign aid, India is quite important. In terms of Canada's, you know, importance to India, well, no, they're not giving very much, especially when you look at what the Americans are giving.
In fact, our aid program in India came to an embarrassing end when the Indian government said,
yeah,
you're not giving
open.
Enough, we only want to play with the big kids. If you want to give your aid to NGOs, that's fine, but otherwise we're not interested.
Yeah.
And we kind of scuttled away, and that was the end of India.
Yeah. And that was a BJP government. It was important for this continuing quest for autonomy.
But right from the start, that was understood, that aid was always going to be a drop in the bucket, and that I mean, the whole issues around trade, not aid, have been central since the 1960s. All of those other kinds of arguments that, and as you say, remittances, although that's another one of these kind of, I think, someone's myths about orgasm. But even still, I mean, this notion that, I go back to things like the Pearson Report, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily come out of the Pearson Report, but comes out in some of the discussions that go into its production, that, you know, remittances from the global south to quote unquote the first world or developed nations, I mean, far outweighs the amount of money, technical assistance, or whatever kind of dollar values you're going to put on it, simply the amount of debt that they owe, quote unquote, owe to the development. You know, every $1 goes out, $3 come back, right? So this notion here, and I think this is where we get into maybe some of these notions about the disconnect between the reality and the myth, right, is that somehow this is something that Canada is doing, we're giving aid. Well, we're not really, because we know that most of those $8 are spent in Canada, they're spent on, you know, giving even technical assistance, right, and that pays for people to go off and do their trade somewhere else. But, you know, and again, even on migration, that we allow refugees in, right? So it's our beneficence by which we do this, right? So somehow people got here. How did they get here? Well, because we must have let them in, right? So you were chosen to become a Canadian, right? And I think that's where a lot of this kind of disconnect between the reality. It's the way in which this is expressed in language. I think people can sometimes see that disconnect, but the language by which we express that automatically privileges those who are here and making this.
You mentioned the Pearson Report. I pull it off the shelf two or three times a year in my work because nothing much has changed.
No.
You could change the numbers, you could change some of the names, and a lot of people wouldn't know that it was written 45 years ago. He didn't have anything to say about the environment or gender, but almost everything else that we are concerned about today is in that report. And that says something about history and our ability to remember things. I wonder if our panelists have any last comments before we break up.
I would just make a very short comment about the distinction between aspiration and fact. I do think a lot of our self-identity is aspiration. We do express who we like to be. And what we actually do, it's the job of the historian and maybe the social scientist to actually figure out what we actually and let us know. Because certainly our aspirational identity is much rosier.
But I do think your actual sense of the facts are also rosier. I understand the notion of all countries, all peoples, all groups have an aspirational identity. But countries a lot of it is also, of course, you know. But I do want to make one quick point about not replacing one myth for another. The idea of remittance is seen, of course, an appealing one, and it's easy to dismiss aid or anything else under the rubric of remittances. But do remember that remittances are coming from people who left their countries and drained their countries of resources, and it's unclear. It is absolutely unclear that it makes up for the absolute devastations. The country I came from, Jamaica, saw 85% of its tertiary graduates leave in the decade that I left. And when 85% of your tertiary graduates leave, this is, you have to send a lot of money home.
And who do they get replaced with, right? They get replaced with workers who should be, and again, Pearson Report recognizes this. So.
Last comments?
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you all. Thank